And tonight I focused on food and poverty, although the same nurse tries to read across the environmental and economic and health issues more broadly. And the point in the report to date makes it very clear that we can't simply go down a cheap food road as if the rest of the global food system doesn't matter when it comes to solving issues of food and poverty. So we have to frame our food and poverty responses within that broader environmental agenda. And that's very, very clear from the UN Sustainable Development Goals that will be published later this year. The thing hangs together. So having said that, I'm not going to dwell on the environmental issues, except to say that as a framing remark, what we're experiencing in terms of food is not a natural disaster. This isn't Vanuatu. This isn't a tornado or hurricane. This is a man-made, a person-made, a socially constructed disaster. And it's really important that we mirror that in the way we respond to it, because we're making this problem and we can unmake it. But it also means we shouldn't be using approaches and ways of thinking which might be suitable to a natural disaster, talking about emergency food aid, but which we have abandoned using in the development context for the last 30 years when you're dealing with ongoing chronic injustice and poverty. So we don't use those in development circumstances. We shouldn't be using them in the UK either. And the second thing I want to say is that the emergence of food banks in the last few years should have been a wake-up call. They should have been a chance for people to think, we need to do something about poverty, because if people are queuing at food banks, we have a poverty issue. They are the canary in the coal mine, and counting the number of people who go to food banks is like counting dead canaries. We have to stop counting dead canaries and sort out the coal mine. And these are very obvious remarks, but I think we need to keep coming back to basics. 10, 15 years ago, if you told me we would be talking about food banks in the UK, I would have said, you're joking, we're not going there. And here we are, talking as if they're going to be something we're going to be living with for a long time. I think that's totally unacceptable. I think we need to see the end of food banks, you know, by 2020 at the very latest, and we need to put every policy lever in place to make sure that happens. Okay, so I'll say just a little bit about that and where we see... put it in a little bit of context. Now, I'm not going to read all this to you, but this is John Boyd Orr's report on food, health and income, which was published in 1936, so about 80 years ago. And it makes sobering reading what he says. And this work, I think we're not doing. It's very odd when you add together the Defra Family Food Survey and the Joseph Rowntree stuff, and stuff. It's still actually very hard to get at what are people eating week on week. You know, do we actually know what they're eating? He seems to be able to find out what people are eating. And perhaps that's because we ate simpler food in those days, like eggs and milk and bread and meat and potatoes, whereas what we eat today doesn't bear much resemblance to those rural products. But what he said was that bread and potatoes, carbohydrate consumption was practically the same across the income groups, but the wealthier you are, the more good food you got to eat, whether that was milk or eggs or meat or fruit and vegetables. And that for the poorest group, which he reckoned at about 10% of the population, the 4.5 million people, he says their diet is inadequate in every respect. And if you look at the UK now, you could probably make the same statement about the diet of the poorest 10% of our population. It's inadequate in every respect. So what progress have we made, you ask, despite having producing more food and making the food in headline terms cheaper? It's also interesting that in that report, for people on less than 10 shillings a week income, they were spending 4 shillings a week on food. So the 40% figure isn't so far off the figure that the report, the draft report, talked about yesterday, 35%. And he goes on to say that as income increases, disease and death rate decrease, and that poor children, if they're fed properly, grow to be as tall as rich children. Right? At the moment, we're not feeding children in poor families properly, and they won't grow as tall as rich children. And we will see the effect of this for a generation. Poor nutrition for pre-fives, we will see the effect of for a generation. I'm not sure who's monitoring it, but that would be my guess. And to make the diet of people on low incomes the same, we have to help people have more fruit, vegetables, milk, eggs, etc. This is not rocket science, right? But we need an approach to nutrition as a public good in the UK, which says the health of our population and the adequate nutrition of our population is a public good and needs to be an object of public policy. But as John Boyd says, towards the end of his book, he says one of the main difficulties in dealing with these problems is that they are not within the sphere of any single department of state. And he calls for statesmanship. Well, that seems to be in short supply at the moment. So, just a bit of context. In terms of the right to food, Nourish Scotland advocates an approach to food and poverty based on rights, not charity. And in our view, social security includes food security. As simple as that. We're tired of people talking about welfare. We're tired of people talking about benefits. We set up a social security system, and that's the term we should use, and that social security includes food security. Mike Small used a lovely phrase recently. He talked about food insecurity as the ultimate precarity. If we talk about people in the precariat, the ultimate precarity is not knowing where your next meal is coming from. And we have far too many people in 2015 in that circumstance. We know that income wealth differentials will take a decade or more to do much about, given our economic model. We know that. And Nourish is committed to seeing a reduction in inequality. But we also think there are short and medium term measures we can take to reduce the gap in nutritional inequality between rich and poor. There are obvious things we could do, but it means starting with this idea about food and nutrition as a public good. Housing is a good example. So in Scotland, we have this assumption that homeless people have a right to housing, right? A sort of basic right, that if you're homeless, you should have a right to housing, and you can go to local authority and get some sort of housing. It doesn't mean that it's great housing, it doesn't mean it happens all the time, it doesn't mean there aren't bureaucracy, it doesn't mean there's not homelessness, but there's a basic assumption in Scotland that you have a right to a house. And our view is that there should be a basic assumption that you have a right to food. And that similarly, quite a lot of that should be devolved to a local authority context and within that to communities. And there's a nice quote from a recent research report on that, just how different the approach is, because it's clear from local authority staff in Edinburgh, in this example, that staff they understand that people have this right, and that the context of the conversation is very different because it's based on an entitlement and expectation, not on a charity approach. And I'm not going to say more about education, but if we had to pay for primary education in this country, like unfortunately people have to do in lots of parts of the world, none of us would think that it was an acceptable response to people being unable to afford education that we had donations in every school of second-hand textbooks and that we made people queue and we gave them out, but they could only get three books. You know, that's not how we do education with people. If we were paying for education, then people couldn't afford it. So why are we doing this with food? I think we have to fundamentally rethink our whole approach to food as a public good. And just some very small things to say about things you could do if we put the right to food into practice. You know, we don't expect we're going to go as far as Ecuador in the Scottish Constitution or in the implementation of the UN International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. But it's very interesting in a country like Ecuador that it's embedded in a wider context of food sovereignty. The right to food is seen part of a food policy that's promoting small-scale farmers, it's promoting good nutrition. And we'd want to see the right to food in Scotland being similarly embedded in a wider understanding of food sovereignty. But I was talking to somebody yesterday saying, well, civil servants won't be keen to do that because they'll say, well, how could we possibly implement that? And I think it's clear that you could implement huge elements of this actually without too much difficulty. So just some very small examples. We currently subsidise farming in Scotland to tune around £500 million a year. That's the equivalent for the poorest 1 million people in Scotland of £10 a week to spend on food. At the moment, most of that cap subsidy ends up basically inflating the price of land and is discounted by the supermarkets to buy the food because they already know what the farmers are getting in terms of subsidy. So I'm not saying we take farm subsidy away from farmers, but I'm saying we need to rethink in the next cap round about a food policy, not an agricultural policy, and how can we use that £500 million much more effectively to promote good food in Scotland. But there are lots of other small examples. Pre-fives is an obvious one. What would it take to have a whole set of community food hubs around Scotland where if you've got kids under five, you can go and eat with your kids as often as you like? No referrals, no clienthood. You don't have to become a client. You don't have to fill in your name and address. You can just go and eat with your kids as often as you like. Because one of the groups that we give very little support, actually in relation to this, is young parents. You know, we bemoan issues about what parents feed in their children, but we actually give very, very little practical support for that. But if you take other groups, particular groups in the population, we know that with older people, poor nutrition results in huge delays in people being discharged from hospital because nutrition is poor even in hospital. We know that it's we know for prisoners, nutrition is poor. There are all sorts of groups in society where a sensible approach to nutrition would both be humane but also economically sensible. And for nourishing all these conversations, we keep asking, where's the food? You know, where's the food in healthcare? Where's the food in childcare? Where's the food in education? We have free parks. Where's the food? Why do we have big waiting lists for allotments and free parks? You know, so we're always saying we want a joined-up approach to food, and as part of that, you focus on the people who most need public help with food. That's our evidence.
Thank you very much.